Okay, so our next speaker is William White, who's the Chief Scientist at Security Innovation, where he is responsible for the strategy and research behind Security Innovation's activities in vehicular communications and security and cryptographic research. William holds a Doctor of Philosophy from Oxford University on statistical mechanics of neural networks. And before joining Security Innovation, he was CTO for NTRU Cryptosystems and senior cryptographer with Baltimore Technologies in Dublin, Ireland. William will be speaking to us on the subject of hardware security requirements for vehicle-to-everything communications. Please welcome William White.
Thanks very much, Aaron. And as you can see, I'm no longer Chief Scientist with Security Innovations. Actually, I am. We haven't finished the spin-off. Things take longer. We were targeting 1st of March. But anyway, at some point, I'll be CTO of Onboard Security. And Onboard Security is basically the embedded practice of Security Innovation. So where we were doing the vehicle-to-vehicle communications, where we were doing the crypto research, the embedded security, trusted computing, all of that is going to be moved into a separate, smaller, better-focused company. We found that Security Innovation as a whole, which also included some professional services, some developer training, security awareness, we found that Security Innovation as a whole confused investors. And the last thing you want to do is confuse investors. So two separate companies, much clearer for everyone. As you can see, it's also a very... the company is so new that we have a smiling lady on our title slide, because it's nice to look at smiling ladies, apparently. Hopefully we'll get something a little more specialized going forward, but this is what we've got for now. So what I'm going to do in this presentation is talk about the connected vehicle security subsystem, obviously explain what the connected vehicle system as a whole is, talk about current deployments, talk about the platform and hardware security requirements that we've considered in trial deployments to date, and the current requirements for the pilot deployments. Again, I'll explain what all of these are. Looking forward, provide an overview of the ongoing research efforts that are going to give us timelines for a final set of requirements, and present on current certification practices for VTech security. So, a bit of background to note is that there are, sorry, I've lost my thought. We'll go with this outline for now. One thing to note is that very similar to what Dr. Damon was talking about in his keynote, this is a setting where you've got multiple applications running on the same device. We're going slightly beyond the standard cryptographic module setting, looking much more at the platform as a whole, the security requirements for the platform as a whole. One thing we're going to do is look at the interaction between the two. And one interesting thing about this setting is that connected vehicle is a new technology area. And a lot of what's going on here is slightly reinventing the wheel, slightly kind of coming up to speed with industry best practices in other settings. And so what we have here is an opportunity, and one thing that might be interesting in this presentation is to understand how these new industry areas go about the process of understanding their security requirements and their certification requirements. So the motivation for connected vehicle is traffic safety. There's 32,000 road deaths in the US a year. That was ticking down a little, but it turned out that was because the economy was bad. Once the economy picked up, people started driving more and they started dying more. So there's an insane number of people killed on the road, and it's something that society has accepted in exchange for the benefits, but if there's anything we can do to reduce it, that would be great. More than 3 million people injured per year, leading cause of death for ages 15 to 34 in the US. So there's been a number of different initiatives over the last, in the 1990s, to move from accident survivability to accident avoidance. So you go from seatbelts and airbags to radar and LIDAR and other sensors. Everybody's seen ads where the ball runs, goes out in the street and the car stops. Drivers are a causal factor for at least 80% of all crashes. People space out. So if there's anything you can do to improve driver awareness or even to drive autonomously, that's going to do a significant amount to reduce the to reduce accidents and reduce this death toll. So what we're seeing is a lot of development of short-range radar that used to be very much a high-end vehicle thing that's moving its way down the value chain. It's still not in all vehicles. And that's very useful for low speed, and it's very useful for line of sight. But those on their own don't cover all the cases where accidents happen, and in particular they don't cover all the cases where serious or potentially fatal accidents happen. So since 1999 there's been this government funded research program called various things over the year, currently called Connected Vehicle, and they've been looking at vehicle to vehicle wireless communications. The idea is that you have a medium access mechanism that's based on 802.11p, but you don't need to do an association beforehand, so you can just do ad hoc broadcasting. It allows very efficient broadcast communications, and so each vehicle 10 times a second sends a basic safety message, and that contains information where I am, where my speed, my acceleration, steering wheel angle, brake status, even windshield wiper status, because that tells you something about whether or not the road's likely to be wet, it tells you something about driving conditions, and that allows the receiving unit to predict collisions and warn the driver. DOT's calculated that if there was full penetration of this and no other active safety system, then that would prevent 80% of unimpaired two-vehicle crashes. In other words, crashes where the driver isn't drunk and crashes where you don't drive into a lamppost where there's actually two vehicles involved. Given that we are seeing this widespread penetration of radar and other collision avoidance technologies, you're not going to see V2V on its own preventing that dramatically large number of accidents, but it'll still the estimates are still that at full penetration there's like 2,000 fatalities a year that are caused by accidents that can be prevented by V2V but not by any other sensor mechanism. And so some examples here. This is what's called left turn assist on the left hand side. The car in the far corner wants to turn left. There's another car coming up. The view is blocked by the truck. In this case, the car turning left can be informed that there's a car coming through and can choose not to make the left turn. Likewise, in the middle one, you've got the blue car is not going to stop at the yield sign because the driver's texting, and the red car is out of sight. But again, because this is a multipath medium, because reflection works in this case, the blue car and the red car can communicate with each other and know they're there. Ambulances can ask cars to pull them on the side. There's another one. If the ambulance and the car in the middle are swapped and the car in front jams on the brakes, then it can send out an extended brake light warning so that the car in back doesn't need to wait for the ambulance driver to notice before they're aware of the braking. So these two cases, these intersection movement assist, left turn warning, and extended brake light, those are the major use cases that really provide safety benefits for V2V that no other technology addresses. So this is quite a promising technology, and over the last, since 2006, there have been a number of field trials. There was a big one in Ann Arbor in 2011, 2,500 vehicles. Right now, there's three pilot deployments. One's happening in New York City. They're instrumenting all the taxis. It's going to be 8,000 vehicles on the road. And they're also going to be instrumenting some intersections that have prox loops, so you can sense a pedestrian crossing against the lights. There's a lot of fatalities on Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn at midnight because it turned out that whatever about drunk driving, drunk pedestrians are a menace to themselves, and there's people staggering out into the roads. And if you can warn taxi drivers that there's a pedestrian in the road, you can actually. We expect to see a downtick in fatalities just from that alone. Tampa is looking to improve the commute experience. Tampa has this freeway going into the town where there's lanes that reverse direction in the middle of the day, and a lot of drivers get confused by that, especially once you're new to the area. So again, providing better information will reduce accidents. Wyoming is one of the major trucking corridors in the country, and during the winter, bad weather comes in very quickly and trucks literally get blown over in the mountains, and there have been terrifying videos of multi-car pileups caused by that. So if they can be warned about adverse weather conditions before they reach there and they can pull over to one side, you can save lives, you can save money, you can make everything run better. GM is deploying this on the 2017 Cadillac CTS, which I think you can buy today. All the major manufacturers are engaged, and given the benefits of the technology and given the fact that you only get these benefits if everyone has it, the Department of Transportation is currently working on a regulation called the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking that will mandate that all new light vehicles include this technology from 2023 onwards. And that is currently going through the regulatory process. There was a public comment period that closed in the middle of April. The process from here is a little murky. They have the option of saying, based on public comment, we think our initial rule was fine. They have the option of modifying it and having another public comment period. But assuming they don't need to iterate too much, then 2021 to 2023 is the likely land date of this, the likely date on which this mandate will take effect. So that's the motivation, that's the process that's going on. And as I say, right at the moment, these three pilot deployments are in the planning stage, and they're all planning to have devices on the road by October 1st. So this is going to be real. And all of those pilot deployments are also planning not to end at the end of the program, the pilot deployment program, which will be, I think, 18 months from October 1st. They're planning to build this so they can be sustained indefinitely. So what do we have here? You have both devices on vehicles and infrastructure devices sending messages. Those need to be trusted. And there's a standard called IEEE 1609.2, which I'm the editor of, that specifies how you secure messages. So in this case, we've got a there's a set of application identifiers called PSIDs. PSID stands for provider service for historical reasons. PSID identifies the broad class of activities that you're engaging in. And then there's a subfield called the SSP, the service specific permissions, that says exactly what you can do inside that broad field of activities. So the CAs are tied down as to which PSIDs and SSPs they can authorize. Your end user cert says here's the PSID and SSP, and then the receiver checks that the PSID corresponds to the message they got, and the SSP allows the contents of the message. So we've got kind of role-based access control, except, I mean, access control is a funny word to use in this case because it's not ongoing access, but it's role-based permissions. That's the 1609.2 approach. Obviously, different applications may have different appropriate security mechanisms, but a lot of the most common applications that are being deployed are going to use this certificate and this mechanism. So for example, give you a concrete example, this basic safety message in Europe is called the CAM, the Cooperative Awareness Message. and it has extensions on it. One extension is, I'm an emergency vehicle, get out of my way. Obviously, you don't want somebody who can send a basic safety message being able to go around claiming to be an emergency vehicle, so that's controlled by the SSP. There's basically a bit field that comes after the PSID. If that bit is set, you can claim to be an emergency vehicle. If you can't, it's not. If it's not, you can't. And obviously the application needs to check the SSP against the contents, but all the other tests can be done by the security services. We've also got this somewhat scary looking certificate management infrastructure, and the purpose of this is to allow protection of privacy. If this is going to be a mandated system, then we want it to be not that easy to use it to track drivers. So, for example, you sign your messages. If you use the same cert to sign at home and at work, then somebody can go, okay, this is you at home and at work. So vehicles are issued with a number of different certificates, at least 20 a week and probably more, and they can change certificate from time to time. Additionally, we've got various mechanisms and separation of duties inside this credential management system, so there's no one entity that knows the set of certs that go to a car. So, you know, to be concrete about the attack is, if I went to the CA and said, give me 20 certs, and the CA gives me 20 certs, then the CA knows which 20 certs I have. And so an insider at the CA could track me, or if there's a database breach at the CA, anyone can track me. So we've got mechanisms in place to do that. And then, you know, the next step is you still sometimes need to revoke vehicles if vehicles are sending, or devices. If devices are sending bad data, you need to remove them from the system. So we have another mechanism where you can link two messages, but only with a certain amount of effort, requiring cooperation of two entities that aren't, you know, that aren't intended to collude, and using specific auditable interfaces. So, you know, this is slightly privacy compromising. Obviously, you're going around sending out these messages, but we've done our best to make sure that it's not the easiest way people will have to track people they want to track. So that's a lot of background. Now I'm going to talk about the unique challenges for V2V hardware modules. So we've done a few cute crypto things in this system. I'm not going to go into them in detail. One that we've done is what's called butterfly keys. So I mentioned that each device is going to have a large number of certificates. It would be a pain to create a large number of individual cert requests, you know, send them all up and match them coming down. So instead we have this mechanism where the device creates a single cert request, a seed or caterpillar cert request, and an expansion function that lets you generate an arbitrary number of statistically uncorrelated private keys and public keys from a single seed private key and public key. It's fairly straightforward. It's just using discrete log. But it does have this nice property that the device only needs to send up one request at the start of its lifetime, and then the CA can go off and pre-generate all of the certs, so that when it's time for me to download new certs, they're there already, and you're not relying on real-time responses from the CA. But, of course, this is a thing where you're modifying the private keys, or you're taking a seed private key that has to be generated in hardware, and you're applying some other transform to it. That transform needs to be done inside the hardware, obviously, to keep the key secure. And that's something that, you know, a typical PKCS11 device doesn't do. So here, this is one kind of unique thing that the HSM needs to provide. Another thing is the implicit certificate. I'm not going to go through the text in pale on the right, but that's how implicit certificates work. Essentially, implicit certificates are a very clever way of allowing you to combine your certificate with the CA's public key to derive your public key in such a way that it only works if the CA issued the implicit certificate. And because you can do that, you actually end up not needing to have an explicit signature on the certificate. So you save 64 bytes per certificate. We're looking at 10 megahertz channels with a nominal capacity of 6 megabits a second. And we're looking at sending 1,000 basic safety messages a second. So saving 64 bytes on most of those messages is a really significant gain. So it's worth doing, but again, this is something that a lot of standard hardware doesn't do. Another thing, of course, is lots of certificates. So here, there's just an illustration of the CA issues all the certificates. The vehicle sends out different certificates at different times. It looks like different vehicles. But this means that most hardware is set up to manage one certificate at a time. They do have key slots. Having key slots is fairly standard practice, but needing to roll over certificates on this scale to get in 20 certificates and decrypt them and have them all ready is again not exactly standard issue. As Dr. Damon was talking about in the keynote, this OBE is a vehicle platform that potentially can have a lot of different applications installed on it, and so you need to have something in the operating system that distinguishes between the different applications and the keys that are appropriate to them. And so here we're slightly going beyond the HSM to the requirements on the OS itself. And we also have this property that Alan mentioned, the certificates are automatically issued. I send a certificate request at the start of the device's lifecycle. The CA pre-generates the certs, and then when I go to ask for more, it does a quick revocation check, and if I pass that, it downloads the certificate. So this kind of automatic rollover of certificates is again a slightly new thing. In a lot of settings, getting a new certificate is a big deal. In this case, getting a new certificate is just an automatic top-up that happens. Your enrollment certificate, your long-lived certificate, is the one that says you're entitled to get the application certs. The application certs are much more like Kerberos tickets in the sense that they're short-lived and attest to a decision that's already been made elsewhere. And there are already many vendors that are making HSNs that support these operations. NXP, AutoTalks, Renesas, there are probably others. So these technical challenges aren't insuperable, they're just work that needed to be done. So that's the overview of what we're doing that's unusual. So now, obviously, if you've got a certificate, if you're a trusted device, well, coming out from the other direction, in order for you to be issued with a certificate, the CA needs to be satisfied that the device is appropriately secure. What does appropriately secure mean? And one thing that I think it's illustrated by this discussion of the difference between emergency vehicles and ordinary vehicles is that appropriately secure is it's an application-specific or a usage-specific meaning. So there isn't the kind of one-size-fits-all appropriate security level. Now, having said that, obviously, it would be great to just make everything as secure as possible, but this is a very cost-sensitive industry. There's a lot of discussion at the moment, for example, about whether FIPS 140 Level 2 or Level 3 hardware security is appropriate, and that's driven very much by cost considerations. 5 cents really does make a difference. Even in the context of a device that at the moment is a bill of materials cost of over $100, argue for lower cost by lowering security levels to a level that's still appropriate but not as expensive, that does make a big difference to the ability of OEMs to deploy. So, as I said, the threat model is application specific. It's not just vehicles. So, for example, down there on the bottom right-hand corner, you can see a border crossing. And obviously, freight management at border crossings is a huge deal. If you can do that wirelessly and securely, then there's significant efficiency gains to be had. But obviously, the security requirements for that are going to be different from the security requirements for a bus telling you that it's coming to the stop. So for collision avoidance, actually, bizarrely, although collision avoidance is a big benefit, the threat from false messages isn't that high. You're unlikely to cause physical harm from a false message. The worst you're doing is giving people bad information. Yeah, in the case of this road along the cliff, maybe if they choose to swerve to the right, they'll plummet to their deaths. That's not going to happen in most cases. In most cases, all you're going to see is people braking suddenly. Or in most cases, all you're going to see is people just paying a bit more attention. You know, look up from texting, work out whether or not there's a problem, and you know, the false message will just result in them being annoyed. At some point in the future, maybe people will get used to receiving these messages and they'll tune out a bit more, and in that case, denial of service becomes an actual attack. But we aren't at that stage, obviously. So for collision avoidance, actually, there is a sound argument that you don't need to go crazy on the physical security. But for other applications, we need a methodology for working out security requirements. And so over the last couple of years, this methodology based on the FITS 199 has been developed. You look at the confidentiality, integrity, availability requirements on each of the information flows within an application. The word application is a problem, obviously. Sometimes it means app, sometimes it means a distributed system across a large number of institutions designed to accomplish a business goal. In this case, we're talking about the latter, a distributed system with a lot of different information flows on it. So the approach that's being used, and it was used by all of the pilot deployments, was to take each application you're going to look at, decompose it into the information flows, look at each information flow, see what the confidentiality, integrity, availability requirements are. So this is a case where an emergency vehicle is asking a traffic signal for preemption. In other words, break the cycle that you're normally on, give me a green straight away. And obviously you'll see integrity is a high requirement on that. Naturally, if I can send false messages, then there's a lot of motivation for people to send false messages so they can get places faster. And B, in practice, these days, although it mightn't seem that given the traffic around here sometimes, these days traffic signals are coordinated in such a sophisticated way that if you break the cycle on a signal, then it can cause disruption that fans out over tens of square miles. So you really want to be sure that a signal preemption request is coming from the right kind of vehicle. So for each flow, you go through those, you go through confidentiality, integrity, availability. Then for each device, you look at the flows, the CIA requirements on them, and the confidentiality requirement is the highest inbound or outbound flow. The integrity and availability requirements are the highest outbound flow. Yeah, I don't. If there's an inbound flow to me that has a high availability requirement, that doesn't affect how available I need to be. It just affects what I can do. So you get those. You do this analysis. You work out what the class is of the device, what the requirements are for the device. We consolidated that into a small number of device classes, and currently we're in the process of defining security controls based on those device classes and based on NIST SP 853. So for those of you who aren't familiar, 853 is a menu of security controls very similar to what you'll find in Common Criteria. We went with the NIST approach because it manages privacy slightly better, and because this was an American government-funded project, so you want to use the American standards. So the work is ongoing to produce the definitive list of controls, but note, of course, that this is deriving the security requirements for devices in the system, not just for the hardware crypto module. So when we're looking at certification of devices to play particular roles in applications, we're not looking just at FITS 140 certification, we're looking at something more full-featured, more like Common Criteria. So what's been written so far, There's an RSU specification. Actually, that those bullets are slightly out of date. There's now a V4.1. RSU stands for roadside unit, by the way. So there's an RSU specification that talks about security requirements for the RSU, and there's different procurement documents that have been produced by the pilot deployments. There's no kind of one consolidated document, but there is rough consensus around this one document that's been developed, originating inside the New York City system and being shared with the other pilot deployments on hardware, software, and operating system security requirements. So that document is actually available at that URL below. I'm not sure if these presentations are going to be made available. I hope they are. So the goal is to enable privileged applications to securely use different cryptographic keys. What does privilege mean? Privilege means that when you stick in the key, when you turn on the car, the application just starts. So if you look at the 5140 requirements, there's kind of an assumption in there that the cryptographic module is, it's got some kind of interaction with a person to kick off applications and to authorize the use of the cryptographic material by different processes on the host that the module's communicating with. And in this case, this isn't really the case. When the vehicle starts up, when the device starts up, you're going to have a lot of different applications, each of which might want access to the keys on the HSM, each of which is going to be starting up separately. So applications that start up and have access to keys without explicit authorization by the user, we call privileged applications. So those are the overall goals, to make sure essentially you can use privileged applications securely, you control access to data, you control access to keys. So I can't install another application on the same car that gets access to the BSM signing keys. That access is restricted only to the authorized BSM application. So the document looks at these different architecture types, integrated, connected, where you've got an HSM talking just over a bus to the host processor where the applications are running, and potentially networked, although that doesn't work very well. Yeah, because you end up needing the same level of physical security on the host processor as you have on the HSM, which kind of, why have an HSM? I won't go through these in detail, but these are all fairly common sense ones. We've got manufacturing state and operational state. You can transition back, but you have to wipe the keys, require secure boot, require integrity tests, prevent privileged applications from signing until all the tests pass. Very FIPS 140 standard OS security requirements, including mandatory access control and guaranteed access to processing time for critical applications. Critical, different from privileged, and that's defined on a device-by-device basis. Secure updates, all software is signed by the manufacturer. Running code can't be modified. So this is very much common sense. This is very much what you expect to see. The only, and HSM requirements, again, are very similar to the FIPS 140 requirements, with a requirement that at low, medium confidentiality, medium integrity, we're saying you can get away with FIPS 140 level 2. Higher than that, you need FIPS 140 level 3. This is an informal, high-level document that is reduced under time pressure, but it is useful because it's specific enough that you can make conformance statements about it. You can point to a paragraph and say, yes, I do that, no, I don't do that. Because this is a new space, and because this is there's a lot of vendors that don't have experience with software security, and because the certification program isn't in place yet to do testing of devices, vendors are self-certifying at the moment. Obviously, that's got its own risks. The vendors, when they provide the devices, they also provide a conformance statement about what they've done to conform with those hardware, software, OS security requirements. And although the document talks about FITS 140 level 2 or FITS 140 level 3, it's very careful to say level 2 or level 3 equivalent hardware security, not FITS 140 level 2 hardware security. In other words, we're not implying that your device needs to get FITS 140 certified. And in fact, if you look at those special crypto operations you have to do, it's not clear that a device can be FITS 140 certified. It's not clear that those crypto operations are consistent with FITS 140. And rather than make somebody take the risk and find out that they aren't, we'd rather do the we'd rather just let themselves certify for now and hope to bring in a proper testing regime when the system goes mainstream over the next few years. So that's what people are building to at the moment. The final part of this presentation, I'm just going to talk through alternatives, what's happening in the future, and what the certification program might look like. In Europe in particular, there's been some very good EU-funded research projects to look at automotive security. One project was called Evita for embedded vehicle security. And you can see from 2008 to 2011, Evita came up with these three designs, low, medium, and high, for internal components, kind of routing components within the car, and components that communicate with other devices outside the car, respectively. I put that slide in twice. And between Evita and another project, Oversea, this architecture was come up with for essentially communicating devices in cars. So this is the OBE that we're looking at in connected vehicle. So these are some nice specifications. This was academic industry collaboration, EU funded, and these are a good starting point for developing an in-vehicle system that supports connected vehicle. I don't think there's anything in here that's inconsistent with what's in the document, the pilot deployment we're using, but I'll be honest, that side-by-side comparison hasn't been done. So the Evita architecture, sorry for the eye chart, you can see there's this light version for sensors and actuators, medium version for standard ECUs, and full version for VTX and large ECUs. And they all have a certain amount of secure boot of self-test. The difference lies in what additional crypto operations they support, what kind of storage they have for private keys, that kind of thing. So the Evita architecture is more of a reference architecture than a product spec. There is a product called SHE, secure hardware element, which is based on the Evita medium that a number of vendors provide, but it's not a kind of one-to-one correspondence. So this isn't a standard, this is more of a baseline. Other approaches, in the proposed mandate, it actually doesn't say anything about these operating system requirements, and my company put in comments during the public comment period, and one of the comments we put in was you really need to go beyond saying use FITS protection for the private keys. You need to say something about having a secure OS as well. So the mandate requires FITS 140 level 3 protection for keys. The draft regulation. So I personally would not like to see that draft regulation go into force. I'd like to see it slightly modified. I think it needs to think about securing it a little more of a holistic system approach. But it's a start, and there's a lot of discussion of security in that document that's quite interesting. SAE J2745/2 is the document the auto industry produced saying how you do basic safety messages and how you protect them. And that specifies security and also just really specifies the hardware equivalent security. And it goes for FITS 140 level 2, where the proposed regulation goes for level 3. Again, this is a cost argument. The argument for level 2 is that if even at level 2, extracting the key is easy for somebody with physical access, but you do need physical access. And so by requiring physical access, you mean that you ensure that the number of compromised devices doesn't scale as the number of vehicles, it scales as the number of attackers. And the number of attackers, it may be in the thousands, but it's unlikely to be in the 10,000s. So just by requiring everybody to kind of go one car at a time, you're putting a kind of natural cap on the number of compromised vehicles. So that's the motivation behind saying slightly lower hardware is appropriate. At the same time, I also hear from various sources that you can get level 3 equivalent hardware security fairly cost effectively these days. So at some point there's going to have to be a come to Jesus meeting where people reveal pricing and decide what's reasonable. The Car-to-Car Communications Consortium is a European consortium. They have a protection profile, an actual common criteria protection profile that is similar but not identical to the pilot deployments document, again, distinguishes between the HSM and the box. AutoSAR is a widely adopted standard for multi-application devices in the automotive environment. It's got security functionality but no platform requirements yet. It's getting a lot of traction though and it's well designed, so I wouldn't be surprised to see everything ultimately converging into a better specified form of AutoSAR. And SAE, so you've seen the acronym twice, that's the Society for Automotive Engineers. They have an ongoing standard, no drafts published yet, J3101, and that is for hardware security for in-vehicle devices. And that was developed by a completely different group from the Connected Vehicle Group, so a challenge over the next year is to get proper convergence between those two sets of requirements so that people aren't building to two different sets of requirements for the same market. As far as certification goes, one interesting wrinkle is the US has a self-certification regime. So I've reproduced some of the notable texts from the DOT website there, but essentially when a car goes on the road in the US, it's not the case that those components have been through some third-party test. When a car goes on the road, the OEM is saying this car is roadworthy. In other words, it meets the FMVSS, the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. And during the course of each year, DOT randomly samples cars from different manufacturers and puts them through a test process to make sure that they're correct, that they are, you know, conformant. Also, obviously, if problems come up during driving, they can get reported and there's a recall process. But this is consistent with the US regulatory approach in general, where they try not to regulate things in advance, but allow innovation and just state requirements and slap you down hard if you've done them wrong. Now, obviously, for vehicle-to-vehicle communications, this is a very different setting from how we usually operate in the automotive space. This is the first time when one car has had to trust the thing that another car is saying. And so it's conceivable in that case that the OEMs will feel pressure to require other people to certify, get actual type certification for their boxes, just so they can be sure that those boxes are providing correct information, haven't been compromised. But that is very much down the road. It may be in the regulation, it may not. So kind of in conclusion, what we have is there's a lot of common sense ideas floating around. There's a lot of there's a growing understanding of what is required for a device to be secure in this setting. We're seeing a certain amount of convergence with other related projects, both in automotive and in the general Internet of Things setting. But exactly what's going to happen, exactly what the requirements are going to be, exactly how you're going to demonstrate you met those requirements, that's still a little up in the air. Thanks very much for your attention, and I'll take questions.
Yes, thank you, William, for a great talk. It was very interesting. Oh, sorry. Oh, can you step up to the microphone?
Thanks. Great talk. Thank you very much. Why do we need to verify the signature. Why do you want to protect the signature verification process? So is it needed? I mean, I'm a signer, I send you something, you verify it, and why it should be protected?
Are you saying why do you verify the signatures, or why the verification process needs?
No, why signature verification process should be protected?
So I mean, that's a good question, and it's a good question in any context. So the requirement that we have in the documents at the moment is that root CA keys are hardware protected against being modified or added to. So because you don't want malware to be able to insert a new root CA key and then get you to accept a false message. Beyond that verification, yeah, so you have that, and then you have, we don't really say a trusted execution environment, but you have secure boot and secure update. So it's kind of poor man's trusted execution environment. So with hardware protection for the root keys, then you get, you know, integrity assurance on the verification. You don't need to do the verification inside the HSM, though. You can do that in software if you can get the performance you need.
Imagine a highway, 6 lanes one way, 6 lanes other way, everybody goes 70 miles an hour, somebody slams on the brakes. How do you perform all the necessary computations to provide response time and warning to the driver, as opposed to after he rear-ended somebody?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair question. In practice, it turns out that they've been, you know, obviously there's been a number of different trials, both through simulations and through on-road trials, and they've determined that even a 400 megahertz post-processor can do that calculation in the necessary time. One important thing is that, especially if you're doing verification in software, you don't verify every message that comes in. You first look at the contents, and then you do context-aware verification, basically. So if the guy's behind me and driving away from me, then I don't care whether the message is valid or not. So first thing, I verify any message I'm going to act on. Next thing, if I have capacity, I verify messages that might be interesting for some other means. And next thing, I put in a hardware accelerator and verify everything. And all three models are acceptable.
That's great. Okay, thank you. This concludes the presentations for the morning in this track. Please make your way to the Hemingway Ballroom, which is, I think, behind me, or the exhibit area for lunch. Conference tracks resume at 1320. Thank you.